cord delicately in his fingers, blowing dust off it, wiping it gently with his sleeve. A crescendo began filling the downstairs. It was no longer the peaceful music we used to hear coming from his room when our mother was there. This felt violent and chaotic, without courtesy. What he chose to play at night on our parents' gramophone felt more like a storm, something tumbling loudly from a great height. It was only after that ominous music was over that the moth would play another record, a quiet voice singing alone. And after a minute or so, I almost imagined a woman had joined in. Someone I believed was my mother. It was what I waited for, and somewhere during that, I fell asleep. Before half term, the moth proposed that if I wished to earn a little money, he probably could arrange a job during the coming holiday. I nodded cautiously. The Sinister Benevolence of the Lift Boy. There were 9 giant laundry tubs revolving endlessly in the basement of the Criterion. It was a grey universe, windowless, separate from any daylight. I was with Tim Cornford and a man named Tolroy, heaving in tablecloths, and when the machine stopped, we dragged them across the room onto other machines that pounded them flat with steam. Whatever we wore was heavy with dampness, and before loading the ironed tablecloths onto trolleys to roll them down the hall, we stripped and ran our clothes through the ringers. On my first day, I thought that when I got home I would tell Rachel everything about what it had been like, but in the end I kept it all to myself. At first it was just the way I was embarrassed by the pains in my shoulders and legs, or the rush of pleasure I had had eating a stolen trifle I'd lifted off the coming evening's dessert trolley. All I did when I got home was crawl into bed, leaving my still wet clothes drying on the banister. I'd been thrown into an exhausting pond life, and now rarely saw my guardian, who was kept busy at the hub of 1,000 spokes. At home, he refused to listen to even an approach of a complaint by me. How I behaved or was treated at work did not concern him. I was offered the chance of night work at pay and a half, and leapt for it. I became a lift jockey, bored, invisible in my velvet-lined carriage, and another evening wore a white jacket and worked in the bathrooms, pretending to be essential to guests who really had no need of me at all. Tips were welcomed, but those evenings were tipless, and I would not be home before midnight, then up again at 6. No, I preferred the laundry. Once, past midnight, after some party had ended, I was told I was needed to help with the transportation of artworks out from the cellar. Significant sculptures and paintings had apparently been transported out of London during the war and hidden in Welsh slate mines. Lesser works were housed in the basements of large hotels and temporarily forgotten, but now they were being gradually lifted back into the light. None of us really knew how far the tunnels under the Criterion stretched. They may even have travelled under Piccadilly Circus. But down there was unbearable heat, and the night staff worked almost naked, as they wrestled those similarly naked statues out from the dark. My job was to work the manual lift in order to deliver these men and women, some with missing limbs, some lying in state with dogs at their feet or wrestling a stag, from our labyrinth of tunnels up to the foyer, and for a while the main lobby would appear as it did during the busiest hours of guest arrivals. A queue of dust-covered saints, some with arrows in their armpits, courteously lined up, as if waiting to register. I stroked the midriff of a goddess as I reached past her to pivot the brass handle so we could travel up one floor, barely able to move in the limited space of that service lift. Then I pulled open the grill, and they all drifted away on skids into the great hall. So many saints and heroes I never knew. By dawn they were travelling towards various museums and private collections in the city. At the end of that short break, I carefully studied my reflection in the school bathroom mirror to see if I had changed or learned anything, then returned to mathematics and the geography of Brazil. Rachel and I often competed over who could best imitate the data. He had, for instance, a furtive walk, as if he were saving energy for a later moment. "Maybe he's waiting for the schwer," Rachel said. My sister, always the better performer, could make it look as if she was scurrying to evade a searchlight. Unlike the moth, the darter was dedicated to quickness. He appeared most at ease in a limited space. After all, he had found early success as the Pimlico darter, crouching in the modest square of a boxing ring, and we believed, unfairly, that at some point he may have spent a few months of his life in the similarly restricted 9 by 6 feet of a prison cell. We were curious about prisons. A week or two before our mother's departure, Rachel and I, imitating trackers in The Last of the Mohicans, had decided to follow her across London. We changed buses twice, and then were appalled to see our mother talking to a very tall man who, holding her by the elbow, led her inside the prison walls of Wormwood Scrubs. The two of us retreated home, never expecting to see her again, and sat in our empty living room, uncertain about what to do. Then were even more confused when she returned in time to cook dinner. I would, in fact, half believe, after the discovery of the trunk, that my mother had never gone to the Far East at all, but had dutifully returned to those prison gates to carry out her postponed sentence for some criminal act or other. In any case, if our mother could be incarcerated, then surely the more obviously anarchic data must at one time have ended up in such a place. We thought him the kind of man who would be most at ease escaping through a claustrophobic tunnel. During the following holiday, I caught another job at the Criterion, washing dishes. This time I was surrounded with company, and most of all could listen to the numerous stories being told or invented. How one had entered the country, smuggled among chickens in the hold of a Polish ship, and then leapt covered in feathers into the sea at Southampton. How another was the illegitimate son of an English cricket player who had bedded his mother beyond a boundary in Antigua, or Port of Spain. All these confessions were dramatically shouted out while surrounded by the 360-degree din of plates, forks, water rushing out from taps like time itself. I was 15 years old now, and I loved it. During the silence of the staggered meal breaks, there was a different atmosphere. One or two sat on a hard chair for the 30-minute lunch, with the rest of us on the floor. Then the anecdotes about sex began, where words like quim were used, and which involved sisters or brothers or mothers of best friends who seduced and educated youthful boys and youthful girls with a generosity and lack of ownership most of them would never witness in real life. The drawn-out, careful lessons of intercourse in all its varieties, described by Mr. Nkoma, a remarkable man who had a scar on his cheek, took the whole lunch break, and I would end up washing dishes and pots for the rest of the afternoon, barely recovering from what I had heard. And if, with luck, Mr. Nkoma was working beside me at Sink 1 the next day or the day after, the plot, like a long, intricate serial of my new friend's youth, would continue with a further sexual episode. He was describing a universe of charms, with all the time in the world, and with seemingly absent husbands, as well as the absence of children. The young Mr. Nkoma had enjoyed piano lessons with a Mrs. Rafferty, and, as if to climax the whole of his apparently fictional storytelling, late one afternoon when some 12 of us were decorating the stage in a banquet room for the night's upcoming event, Mr. Nkoma rolled a stool over to the piano and sat down to play a luxurious melody while we worked. It lasted 10 minutes, and everyone became still. There was no singing, just his educated hands riffling the keys in a sultry and wise way, So it was impossible not to be thereby amazed at the truth of what we had thought were his earlier fictions. And when he finished, he sat there for half a minute, and eventually closed the piano quietly, as if that in itself was the end of the story, the truth or proof of it, of what Mrs. Rafferty in the town of Tioche, 4,000 miles from Piccadilly Circus, had taught him. What did that glimpse of storytelling do to the boy I was? When I think of those episodes, it is not the 46-year-old Mr. Nkoma with his scar I see, but Harry Nkoma, a boy, as I was then. When Mrs. Rafferty made him a tall glass of soursop, told him to sit down, and asked a series of quiet questions about what he wished to do with his life. For I believed that if anything was invented, it was just the graphic paragraphs of sex that he described so freely to his small lunchtime audience. The older man's knowledge from his later life most likely layered on top of a more innocent youth. The truth was in the boy, scarred or perhaps still unscarred, who came with two other delivery boys to Mrs. Rafferty's house, where she had said to him on that first meeting, "You go to the same school as my son, don't you?" And Harry Nkoma had said, "Yes, ma'am." "And what do you wish to do with your life?" He was looking out of the window, not really paying attention to her. "I would like to be in a band. Play the drums." "Oh," she said. "Anyone can play the drums. No, you should learn the piano." She was so beautiful. I still recall Harry Nkoma saying, describing to us all, with a novel-like skill, her colored dress, her thin bare feet, the slim dark toes, and the pale paint on those nails. All those years later, he remembered that clear line of muscle in her arm. So without any disbelief, I fell in love, as Harry Nkoma had, with this woman who simply knew how to speak to a youth, taking her time to listen and think about what he had said, or what she was going to say, pausing, bringing something from the fridge, all of that leading, according to Harry's grown-up tale, to a preparation for those sexual stories none of us could have imagined or was prepared for, as we sat on the floor by the sinks at the Criterion, while Mr. Nkoma sat above us, on one of the two available chairs. He said her hands felt like leaves on him. After he had come in her, this curious and startling act of magic, her palms had brushed his hair back from his face until his heart stopped speeding. It felt like every nerve was finally stilled. He became aware she had most of her clothes on. In the end, it had all been hurried. There had been no uncertainty or torment. Then she slowly undressed, then bent sideways so she could lick the last drop from him. They bathed by an outdoor tap. She poured 3 or 4 buckets of water onto his skull, and it coursed down, his body suddenly aimless. She raised the buckets, and the water fell along her body, and she slipped her hand down within the run of it to clean herself. "You can play concerts in other parts of the world," she said later, during another afternoon. "Would you like to do that?" "Yes." "Then I shall teach you." I sat silent on the floor, listening to this fairness of sharing I already knew existed nowhere else in the world, which could occur only in dreams. In the trolley hall, between the kitchen and the service lifts that rose to banquet level, a game of scratchball took place. Whatever stage an anecdote had reached, whatever tiredness existed among the staff, the last 10 minutes of our lunch were given over to 2 teams of 5, who charged each other in the rectangle of uncarpeted concrete that was 6 feet across. Scratchball was not so much the skill of passing or running, as it was of balance and brute force, where you heaved the scrum of your team forward, all your fury seeming more furious because it had to be done in silence. No verbal damnation, grunts, or yells of pain to betray the anarchy of what was happening in the trolley hall, like old silent footage of a riot. The squeak of shoes, the sound of falling bodies, was all that gave away our lawlessness. Then we lay there, breathing heavily, got up, and went back to work. Mr. Nkoma and I returned to the large sinks, thrust fragile glasses into the rotating bristles, and tossed them a half second later into boiling water, so the person drying would pluck them free as they bounced back up and stacked them. We could do over 100 glasses in 15 minutes. Plates and cutlery took longer, but for now someone else was doing that. And it was just Harry Nkoma and I, with our recent lunchtime anecdotes, subsiding into what felt like needed sleep. Where they belonged, naturally. There was only the great noise of the kitchen in our ears, the taps gushing out water, the huge wet brushes humming in front of us. Why do I still remember those days and nights at the Criterion? That springtime fragment of a boy's youth, a seemingly unimportant time. The men and women I would meet at Ruvigny Gardens were more incendiary, became more significant in the path of my life. Perhaps because it was the only time that boy was alone, a stranger among strangers, when he could choose his allies and opponents for himself from those who worked beside him at the sinks or played on the scratchball teams. When I broke Tim Cornford's nose by accident, he needed to disguise it in order to continue working the rest of the afternoon so he wouldn't lose his pay. He sat there in a daze, got up, scrubbed the blood off his shirt under a tap, and returned to work repainting a chipped floorboard so it could dry by the time guests arrived. For by 6 p.m, most of the ground floor staff would have left the building, like little shoemakers needing to disappear before the real owners returned. I was pleased by now that the moth took no interest in how I was surviving the job or what trouble I was getting into. I hid what I was learning, not just from him, but from my sister, with whom I had once shared everything. The sexual fables of Harry Nkoma went no further, but the afternoons with Mrs. Rafferty would stay, and there was to be a brief, tentative bond with Harry. I remember us raucous at a couple of football matches we went to, or comparing at the end of an exhausting day our boiled hands and the pucker of flesh on each finger, even on those deft ones that had played the piano so surprisingly, still in a room of Criterion workers. Where did he go eventually with that skill? He was already middle-aged. For all I knew, Harry would continue to corner others with his stories. But where was the future that Mrs. Rafferty had promised him? I would never know. I lost him. The two of us used to walk to the bus stop if we finished at the same hour. It took me less than 30 minutes to get home. It took him 2 buses and 1.5 hours. It never occurred to either of us to visit where the other lived. Now and then someone would refer to the moth as Walter, but Rachel and I felt the vagueness of our chosen name for him was more apt. We did not have a stable perception of him yet. Was he really protecting us? I must have longed for some truth and security, much like the 6-year-old boy who had once gone to him to escape a dangerous father. For instance, what was the sieve in the moth that made him choose these specific individuals who filled our house? Rachel and I gloated with excitement over their presence, even if it felt wrong. If our mother had ever thought to phone us from wherever she was, we would no doubt have lied cautiously and said everything was fine, not mentioning the strangers who happened to be crowding into the house at that moment. They did not in any way resemble a normal family. Not even a beached Swiss Family Robinson. The house felt more like a night zoo, with moles and jackdaws and shambling beasts, who happened to be chess players, a gardener, a possible greyhound thief, a slow-moving opera singer. If I attempt now to recall the activities of one or two of them, what emerges are surreal, non-chronological moments. Mr. Florence, for instance, pumping his smoker, which he normally used to calm and stultify his bees, into the face of a guard at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, forcing him to inhale fumes of burning wood combined with a sleep-inducing coal. The uniformed man had his hands held behind his chair as this was happening, and it took a while before his head fell forward, calm as a sleeping bee. So we could walk out of the gallery with two or three watercolors, while Mr. Florence pumped a last gasp of smoke at the unconscious face.
"Right,"
he barked quietly, pleased, as if he had painted an immaculate straight line, and handed me the hot smoker to put away safely. There are many such incompletes and guilty moments I have packed away, meaningless as those unused objects in my mother's suitcase. And the chronology of events has fallen apart, for whatever defensive reason. Each day, Rachel and I took a bus and then the train from Victoria Station to our respective schools. And for about 15 minutes before the bell, I would mill around with the other boys, talking excitedly about radio shows they'd heard the night before, a mystery hour or one of those half-hour comedies, where the humor depended almost totally on the repetition of stock phrases. But now I rarely heard those programs, as our radio listening was constantly interrupted by visitors dropping by to see the moth, or he would take us around the city, and I returned too tired to be curious about another mystery hour. I'm sure that Rachel, like me, never revealed what our home life had really become. The existence of the data, the B-man still under a cloud for his past misdemeanor, and most of all that our parents had gone away. I suspect she pretended, like me, to have heard all those shows, and so nodded and laughed and claimed to being scared by a thriller neither of us had heard. The moth was sometimes gone for 2 or 3 days, often without warning. We ate our dinners alone and trudged off to school the next morning. He would mention later that the data had cruised by in his car to make sure the place was not in the midst of a conflagration. So we had been utterly safe, though the idea of the data's nearby presence on those nights did not give us a sense of security. We'd heard him on other evenings, churning the engine of his Morris, both accelerator and brake pressed down simultaneously, while dropping off our guardian at midnight, and recognized his drunken laughter filling the street as he drove away. The music-loving moth appeared blind to the evident anarchy in the data. Everything the Xboxer did was at a precarious tilt, about to come loose. Worst were the crowded car rides when the two of them sat in the front, while Rachel and I and sometimes three greyhounds squabbled in the back on the way to Whitechapel. We were not even certain that the dogs belonged to him. The data rarely recalled their names, as they sat tense, shivering, their bony knees digging into our laps. There was one that preferred to lounge round my neck like a scarf, its warm belly against me, and once, somewhere around Clapham, it proceeded to urinate, through either fear or need, onto my shirt. I was supposedly going to a school friend's house after the dog races, and when I complained, the data laughed so excessively he had to avoid hitting a Belisha beacon. No, we did not feel safe around him. It was clear he was just putting up with us, and would have preferred we had remained at Walter's house, which was how he referred to our parents' home. Was this even his car? I wondered, for I noticed the number plates on the blue Morris were frequently changed. But the moth was content to move in the data's slipstream. Shy people are drawn to such types for camouflage. In any case, the tensions we felt whenever the moth left home were the result not of our guardian's absence, but of the knowledge that the data had permission to oversee us with that grudging, uninterested concern. One day, I was fighting with Rachel over a book I had lost. She had denied taking it, and I then discovered it in her room. Her arms flailed against my face. I grabbed her neck, and she froze, fell out of my grip and began shuddering and banging her head and her heels against the wood floor. Then a cat-like noise. The pupils slid away, replaced by the whites of her eyes, her arms still flailing. The door opened, letting in noise from the crowd downstairs, and the darter walked in. He must have been passing her room.
"Go away!"
I yelled. He closed the door behind him, knelt down, took my book, The Stolen Swallows and Amazons, and jammed it into Rachel's mouth at the moment she gasped for air. He pulled a blanket that was on the bed over her, then lay down beside her and enclosed her in his arms, until there was only the noise of her breath.
"She stole my book,"
I whispered nervously.
"Bring some cold water. Rub it on her face. Cool her down."
I did that. 20 minutes later, the three of us were still together on the floor. We could hear the moth's acquaintances downstairs.
"Has this happened before?"
"No.
I had a dog once,"
he said it casually,
"who was epileptic. Now and then he'd go off like a firecracker."
The darter leaned against the bed, winked at me, and lit himself a cigarette. He knew Rachel hated him smoking around her. Now she just watched him silently.
"That's a crap book,"
he announced, rubbing his fingers over Rachel's bite marks on the cover.
"You need to take care of your sister, Nathaniel. I'll show you what to do."
How surprising the Pimlico darter could be whenever that other side of him emerged. How good he was that evening, while the moth's party continued downstairs. In those days, there was more fear about the effects of epilepsy, along with the assumption that frequent fits impaired a person's memory. Rachel mentioned these limits after reading about them in the library. I suppose we choose whatever life we feel safest in. For me, it is a distant village, a walled garden. But Rachel tossed away such concerns.
"It's just schwer,"
she would say to me, using her fingers to emphasize the quotation marks. A woman who was going out with the darter had begun strolling into my parents' house, accompanying him, or arriving at whatever hour she was to meet him there. On her first visit, the darter arrived too late to explain who she was, so my sister and I, just home from school, were left to introduce ourselves in the vacuum created by his absence. It meant we got a good look at her. We were careful not to mention other females the darter had already escorted into the house, so we answered her inquiries about him somewhat stupidly, as if we could not remember much about his associates, or even what he did, or where he might be. We knew he liked to breast his cards. Still, Olive Lawrence was a surprise. For someone like the darter, who was so one-sided in his opinions as to the role women ought to have in the world, he appeared to have an almost suicidal tendency to select highly independent women to go out with. They were tested right away by being taken to crowded and noise-filled sports events at Whitechapel or Wembley Stadium, where there was no possibility of private conversation. The triple forecast bets were supposed to provide enough excitement for them. Besides, for the darter, there were no other interesting public locations to visit. He'd never stepped inside a theatre in his life. The idea of watching someone pretend to be real, or of someone saying lines on stage that came from previously written dialogue, felt untrustworthy to him. And as a man on the edge of the law, he needed to feel secure about how reliable the truth was that he was hearing. Only cinemas appealed to him. For some reason, he believed truth had been caught there. Yet the women he was attracted to seemed to be in no way humble or easily persuaded maidens who would happily exist under his rules. One was a painter of murals. Another, after Olive Lawrence departed, was an argumentative Russian. Olive Lawrence, who appeared alone that first afternoon, so that the three of us had to introduce ourselves, was a geographer and ethnographer. She was, she told us, often in the Hebrides recording wind currents, at other times in the Far East being a solitary traveller. There was something in these professional women that suggested it was not a case of the data selecting them, but of the women's choosing him. As if Olive Lawrence, a specialist in distant cultures, had stumbled suddenly on a man who reminded her of an almost extinct medieval species, a person still unaware of any of the principal courtesies introduced in the past 100 years. Here was someone who had never heard of people eating only vegetables, or opening a door for a woman so she might enter a building ahead of him. Who else would have fascinated a person like Olive Lawrence, but this man who seemed to be frozen in time, or perhaps released from a recently discovered sect, now miraculously in evidence in her own hometown? Yet there appeared to be little choice in how women participated with the data. The only rules played by were his. The hour Olive Lawrence spent with us, as she waited for her new beau, was given over to telling us, in a somewhat amazed voice, about the first dinner they had shared. He had found her among the moth's friends, and then steered her to a Greek restaurant, a narrow rectangle of a place with 5 tables and submarine lighting, then proposed they seal a newly found intimacy, that had not in fact occurred but would shortly, with the sharing of a meal of goat and a bottle of red wine. Did something cross her mind then? Some gale warning or other? But she acquiesced.
And bring us the cooked head,
he requested of the waiter. The dark, horrific sentence was said so casually that he could have been asking for a sprig of fennel. She paled at the mention of the goat head, and the nearby customers proceeded to slow their own meals in order to witness the oncoming domestic contest. The data may not have liked theatre, but what followed was a Strindberg-like performance that lasted 1.5 hours with 5 or 6 couples watching. We knew the data was a quick scoffer, because whenever we travelled with him during the dog racing season, he'd crack open and consume a couple of raw eggs while driving his Morris, then toss the shells into the back seat. But at the start of Argyropolis, he took his time. Olive Lawrence sat on a stiff-backed kitchen chair in front of us and reenacted the moment, describing every insistence and refusal, when she had to be convinced or persuaded or bullied, as well as maybe charmed. She was not sure which, she no longer knew. It was all confusing as a nightmare. Into eating the carcass of a goat slaughtered, she was sure, in someone's basement near Paddington. Then the head. The data had won, it appeared, and the intimacy he was expecting did occur 1 hour later in his flat. The 2 bottles of wine had helped, she told us, still downcast. Or perhaps it was because he had believed so securely that he was right, that he was not arguing about consuming the goat's head and the one eye she had to swallow in a vindictive way. The eye had the texture of snot. She actually used that word. And the head had a texture of what? She did not know. She ate it because she could tell he believed in it. It was something she would never forget. By the time the data arrived at our house, full of not very convincing excuses for being late, we had decided we liked her. She had spoken to us of Asia and the ends of the earth, as if they were distant boroughs of London, easily reachable. She spoke about these places in a voice unlike the beleaguered one she had used to describe her Greek meal. When we asked her what she did in her job, she told us exactly what she did.
Ethnography,
she said, slowing the syllables as if we should write the word down fragment by fragment. She spoke of her pleasures as a traveller, told us that in the river deltas of southern India, she had drifted on a boat, with just a minimal two-stroke motor somewhere in its bows. She described the speed of monsoons.
"You were sopping wet, and 5 minutes later your clothes were dried by the sun."
She spoke of a pink-lit tent that housed a small statue of a minor god at ease in its shade, while the world outside was devastated by heat. She was providing us with descriptions our distant mother might have sent in letters. She had been along the Shiluango River regions in Angola, where there was ancestor worship, so that ghosts had supplanted gods. Her talk sparkled. Like the Data, she was tall and slim, with a dazzle of unkempt hair, shaped and reshaped, I am sure, by whatever weather she was in. An independent creature. I suspect she would have eaten a goat if she had slain it herself in some Turkish meadow. The indoor world of London must have made her restless. In retrospect, it was probably the extreme difference between her and the Data that allowed their attachment to last longer than we expected it would. Yet whatever his fascination for her, she also seemed itching to be on her way. Perhaps she was on a break and needed to remain in London writing her reports, after which she would be off again. That small god in its pink tent had to be revisited. It meant leaving every attachment and domestic utensil behind. But it was the moth's relationship with her that we found most curious. Caught between the Data's and Olive Lawrence's differing opinions about practically everything, whenever they clashed in our living room, or worse, in the reverberating confines of the Data's car, the moth refused to take sides. He obviously had need of the Data professionally, for whatever reason, and yet we saw that, though she was most likely just a temporary presence, the moth was intrigued by her. We loved being around the three of them, witnessing their fights. The Data appeared more complex and shaded now, with this generous flaw in him that preferred the company of a woman who contradicted his opinions. Not that his opinions would change. And we loved the dilemma the moth was in, his awkwardness when the Data and Olive Lawrence broke into flames. Suddenly he seemed like the head waiter who could only brush away the broken glass. Olive was the one person who came into our house who appeared capable of clear judgment. She was consistent in her views of the Data. She admitted his tiresomeness alongside his quick and peculiar charm, was appalled as well as fascinated, she told us, by the consummately male taste evident in his disorganized flat at the Pelican Stairs. And I had also seen her regard the moth as if never quite certain if he were a positive or negative force. What was his hold on the Data, her present temporary lover? And was he a benign guardian to the orphan-like boy and girl she had come to know? She always focused on the possibility of character. She weighed character, could discover it in a few grains of a person, even in one's non-committal silence. "Half the life of cities occurs at night," Olive Lawrence warned us. "There's a more uncertain morality then. At night, there are those who eat flesh by necessity. They might eat a bird, a small dog." When Olive Lawrence spoke, it was more like a private shuffling of her thoughts, a soliloquy from somewhere in the shadows of her knowledge, an idea she was still unsure about. One evening, she insisted we catch a bus with her to Streatham Common and walk its slow rise of land to the rookery. Rachel felt uncertain in that open darkness, wished to go home, said it was cold. But the three of us kept moving forward, until we were eventually in the trees and the city had evaporated behind us. Around us were untranslatable sounds, something in flight, a series of footfalls. I could hear Rachel's breath, but there was no sound from Olive Lawrence.
Then in the dark, she began to talk, to distinguish the barely heard noises for us. It's a warm evening, and the pitch of those crickets is in D. They have that sweet, quiet whistle, but it's made with the rub of their wings, not by breath. And this much conversation means there will be rain. That's why it's so dark now. The clouds are between us and the moon. Listen.
We saw her pale hand point near us, to the left.
That scrape is a badger. Not digging, just his paws moving. Really, it's something tender. Perhaps the end of a fearful dream. Just the remains of a small, uneven nightmare in his head. We all have nightmares. For you, dear Rachel, it might be imagining the fear of a seizure. But there need not be fear in a dream, just as there's no danger from the rain while we are under the trees. Lightning rarely comes during this month. We are safe. Let's walk on.
The crickets might move with us. The branches and underbrush appear to be full of them, full of high C's and D's. They can reach as high as an F at the end of summer when they are laying eggs.
Their cries seem to fall on you from above, don't they? It feels like an important night for them. Remember that. Your own story is just one, and perhaps not the important one. The self is not the principal thing.
Hers was the calmest voice I knew when I was a boy. There was never argument in it. She had just this tactile curiosity about what interested her, and that calmness allowed you to be within her intimate space. In daylight, she always caught your eye as she talked or as she listened. She was completely with you, as she was with the two of us that night. A night she wanted us to remember, as I have. Rachel and I would not have walked through the darkness of that forest alone, but we were confident that Olive Lawrence had some tracing in her head from a faint light in the distance or a shift of wind that told her exactly where she was and what she was going towards. There were other times, however, when a different ease took over, and she'd fall asleep, unconcerned, in my father's leather chair at Ruvigny Gardens, her feet tucked under her. Even if the room was full of the moth's friends, the look on her face still intent, focused, as if continuing to receive information. She was the first woman, in fact the first person, I ever saw do that, sleep so casually in the presence of others without guilt, then wake refreshed half an hour later when others were beginning to tire, and stride off into the night, refusing the daughter's not too convincing offer to drive her home, as if she now wished to walk through the city alone, with a new thought. I would go upstairs and watch her from my bedroom window, as she entered and passed each pool of streetlight. I could hear her whistling faintly, as if recalling a tune, something unknown to me. In spite of our night journeys, I knew Olive's profession usually meant daylight work, measuring the effects of nature on coastlines. She had worked, apparently, within the Admiralty on sea currents and tides, barely out of her teens, during the first stages of the war. She admitted to this modestly, only after it had been almost revealed by someone in the Moth's group. There were all these landscapes within her. She could read the noise of forests. She had timed the rhythm of the tidal slop along the embankment at Battersea Bridge. I am always curious why Rachel and I never ventured into a life like hers and her vivid example of independence, as well as empathy for everything around her. But you must remember we did not know Olive Lawrence for that long. Though the night walks, accompanying her along the bombed-out Docklands or into the echoing Greenwich Foot Tunnel, our three voices singing a lyric she was teaching us.
Under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon.
I will not forget. She was tall, lithe. She must have been lithe, I suppose, with the data, when she was his lover for the brief period of that unlikely relationship.
I don't know. I don't know. What does a boy know? I always saw her during that time as self-sufficient. For instance, when she slept in our semi-crowded living room in a state of separateness from all the others. Is this the censorship or tact of the young? I can more easily see her embracing a dog, lying on the floor beside it, the weight of its head on her throat, so she is scarcely able to breathe, but content to let the animal remain there, that way. But a man dancing close to her? I imagine a response of claustrophobia in her. She thrilled to open space and weather nights, as if she could never be contained or fully revealed there. And yet of all those acquaintances and strangers who walked into and out of the house at Ruvigny Gardens, she was the most distinct. She appeared to be the accident, the outsider at our table, whom the data had discovered at my parents' house, and more surprisingly taken up with, so she would soon be known as the data's girl. "I'll send you two a postcard," Olive Lawrence said when she eventually left London, and then was gone from our lives. But somewhere on the borders of the Black Sea, or at some small village post office near Alexandria, she would indeed mail us a platonic billet doux about a cloud system in the mountains that suggested an alternative world, her other life. The postcards became our treasures, especially as we knew there was now no communication between her and the data. She'd journeyed out of his life without a backward glance. The idea of a woman mailing a postcard as part of a promise to two children far away indicated an expansiveness as well as aloneness, a hidden need in her. It signaled two very different states. Though, perhaps not. What did that boy know? There are moments after I put down such thoughts about Olive Lawrence when I almost believe I am composing a possible version of my mother while she was away, doing something I knew nothing about. Both these women were in unknown locations, though of course it was only Olive Lawrence who courteously and beyond the call of duty mailed postcards to us from wherever she was. And there is the third corner of the triangle these two women made up, which I also consider now. It is Rachel, who needed a close relationship with a mother during that time, to protect her in the way a mother could. She had walked between Olive and me that night, up the slow incline of hill into Streatham Woods, being told that when she was in the darkness with us, there would be no danger, that there was no danger even in dreams or during the unstable tumult of her seizures. There were only crickets in song above us, only the scratch of a badger as it turned in comfort, only the hush and then a sudden whisper of the oncoming rain. What had our mother assumed would happen to us in her absence? Did she think our lives would be like that popular play of the day, The Admirable Crichton, which she had taken us to see in the West End, our first play, where a butler, in our case I suppose the equivalent of the moth, kept an aristocratic family well disciplined and therefore secure, in a sort of upside-down world on a castaway island? Did she really assume that the shell of our world would not crack? Sometimes, under the influence of whatever he was drinking, the moth became cheerfully incomprehensible to us, in spite of the fact that he appeared assured about what he thought he was saying, even if what he said involved a few clauses falling away from the path of the previous sentence. One night, when Rachel had been unable to sleep, he pulled a book called The Golden Bowl from my mother's shelf and began reading to us. The manner of the paragraphs, as the sentences strolled a maze-like path towards evaporation, was, to the two of us, similar to the moth's when he was being drunkenly magisterial. It was as if language had been separated from his body in a courteous way. There were other evenings when he behaved strangely. One night, the radio described the manic act of a man who had pulled passengers out of a Hillman Minx in front of the Savoy and then set fire to the car. The moth had returned only an hour earlier, and listening intently to the report, groaned, "Oh, God, I hope that was not me." He glanced down at his hands as if he might find traces of paraffin on them. Then, seeing our concern, dismissed the possibility with a wink. It was clear we now did not even understand his jokes. In contrast to him, the data, while more excessive in his inventions, had no sense of humor, like any person who is not fully legal. Still, the moth had this almost reliable stolidness, and perhaps he was our admirable Crichton after all, even when measuring that cloudy liquid into his small blue glass cup that had once been attached to a bottle of eyewash and drinking it down as if it were sherry. We did not mind the habit. It was the one time he was serenely open to our wishes, and Rachel could always persuade him at these moments to take us into parts of the city he appeared to know well. The moth had an interest in abandoned structures, such as a 19th-century hospital in Southwark, which had been active long before the days of anaesthetic. Somehow he got us into the place, and lit the sodium lamps so they shivered against the walls of the dark operating room. So many unused locations in the city that he knew of, lit by 19th-century light, shadowed and ominous to us. I wonder whether Rachel's later theatrical life was formed by those half-lit evenings. She must have perceived how one could darken and make invisible, or at least distant, what is unhappy or dangerous in a life. I think her eventual skill with limelight and fictional thunder allowed her to clarify for herself what was true and what was false, safe and unsafe. By now, the data was stepping out with the Russian, who owned such a flaring temper that he was to bail out from that relationship before she could discover his address. This, of course, meant she too would turn up at Ruvigny Gardens, looking for him at odd hours, sniffing the air for a scent of him. He became careful and never parked his car on our street. The presence of the data's various partners meant I was suddenly closer to women than I had ever been, apart from my mother or sister. The school I went to took only boys. It was a time when my thoughts and friendships should have been with them. But Olive Lawrence's ease of intimate conversation, the way she spoke so directly about her wishes, even her desires, brought me into a universe that was distinct from anywhere I had previously been. I became intrigued by women who were outside my realm, with no blood or sexual motive. Such friendships were not controlled by me, and they would be passing and brief. They replaced family life, yet I could remain at a distance, which is my flaw. But I loved the truth I learned from strangers. Even during those dramatic weeks with the spurned Russian girlfriend, I hung around the house more than I needed to, and hurried home from school in order to simply watch her pace our living room with that unsatisfied look on her face. I would walk past her and brush her arm so I could collect that moment. I once offered to accompany her to the dog track at Whitechapel, supposedly to help her find the data, but she waved my offer away, perhaps guessing I might have another motive to get her out of the house. She was unaware, in fact, how close she was to the data, who was hiding in my room, reading the Beano. In any case, the curious pleasure of female company was in me now. Agnes Street. That summer, I found a job in a fast-paced restaurant in World's End. I was back to washing dishes and filling in as a waiter whenever someone was ill. I was hoping to meet up with Mr. Nkoma, the piano player and fabulist, but there was no one I knew. The staff were mostly quick-witted waitresses, North Londoners and girls from the country, and I could not take my eyes off them because of how they talked back to bosses, how they laughed, how they insisted they were enjoying themselves even though the work was hard. They had a higher status than those of us in the kitchen, so we were barely worth talking to. That did not matter. I could watch and learn about them from a distance. I worked there, shy at the center of the busy, pauseless restaurant, and their speed of argument and laughter kept me entertained. They'd walk past carrying three trays, proposition you, and walk off during your stammer. They rolled up their sleeves to show you their stringy muscles. They were forward, then suddenly distant. A girl, a green ribbon holding back her hair, came across me in a corner during my lunch break and asked if she could borrow the small piece of ham out of my sandwich. I did not know what to say. I must have handed it to her silently. I asked what her name was, and she looked shocked at my forwardness, ran back and organized a group of three or four waitresses to circle me and sing about the dangers of desire. I was about to enter a borderless terrain between adolescence and adulthood. When a few weeks later I had my clothes off in the company of that girl on a worn carpet of an empty house, I found the pathway towards her invisible. What I knew of passion was still an abstract thing, layered with hurdles and rules I did not yet know. What was just and what was unjustified? She lay beside me and there was no submission. Was she as nervous as I was? Besides, the real drama of the episode was not about us, but the situation, which had involved illegally entering a house on Agnes Street with keys she had borrowed from her brother, who worked for an estate agency. There was a for sale sign outside. Inside, there was no furniture, just carpeting. It was nightfall, and I could interpret her responses only with the help of a streetlight, or from a series of single matches held above a section of carpet that we checked later for bloodstains, as if there might have been a murder there. It did not feel like romance. Romance was the energy and sparkle of Olive Lawrence. It was the incandescent sexual fury of the darter's spurned Russian, whose beauty was increased by her heightened suspicion of him. Another evening in midsummer. We have a cold bath in the house on Agnes Street. There's no towel to dry ourselves, not even a curtain we can rub ourselves against. She pulls back her dark blonde hair, then shakes her head, and her hair loosens into an aura.
"Everyone else, they're probably having cocktails now," she says.
We dry ourselves by walking through the empty rooms. This is the most intimate we have been since entering the house around 6 o'clock. There's no longer the plot of sex or focused desire. Just ourselves naked as well as invisible to each other in the dark. I catch, because of the swerve of a car light, a smile from her in recognition of this. A small awareness between us.
"Watch,"
she says, and does a handstand into the dark.
"Didn't see it. Do it again."
And this once seemingly unfriendly girl somersaults towards me, saying,
"Catch my feet this time."
Then,
"Thank you,"
as I slowly lower her down. She sits on the floor.
"I wish we could open a window, run in the street."
I don't even know what street we're on anymore.
"It's Agnes Street. The garden. Come."
In the hall downstairs, she pushes me to move faster, and I turn, grab her hand. We are wrestling against the staircase, each unable to see the other. She leans forward, bites my neck, and pulls away from an embrace.
"Come on,"
she says.
"Here."
Banging into a wall. It's as if neither of us thinks of anything except to escape this closeness, and it is only closeness that will help us escape. We are on the floor kissing whatever we reach, her hands beating my shoulders as we fuck. It isn't lovemaking.
Don't let go. No.
Escaping her tightening arm, I hit my head on something, a wall, banister, then come down hard onto her chest, suddenly aware of her smallness.
Somewhere here we lose consciousness of each other, simply discovering the joy in the